Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ken Rudin.
And I'm Mara Liasson, sitting in for Ron Elving.
Well, Ron's not here this week, and Mara Liasson is. Mara Liasson actually is at the White House. You were just listening to Joe Biden give a speech. Joe Biden, I think the first 3 hours of Joe Biden's speeches are the best. What do you think, Mara?
Very funny. It was a very sober speech, but it was a campaign speech on foreign policy, which was kind of interesting. It was built as a campaign speech, not as an official vice presidential speech.
So, in other words, he didn't announce that he's resigning, stepping down, so Hillary Clinton could replace him on the ticket.
No.
Because I expected that, as most Washington insiders expected that.
Yes.
Okay, but the real thing that we did expect, and was not a surprise, was Mitt Romney's sweep of 5 states this week. But the real headline is Newt Gingrich gets 27% of the vote in Delaware. Basically, that's winning Delaware. Why isn't he still in the race, Mara Liasson, I ask you?
Because he's broke, he's in debt, there's nowhere for him to go. He won 2 states, and that was about it, and he's going to drop out next week.
No, what's strange to me is that he said that if he doesn't do well in Delaware, his campaign is over. Does that mean, is the obverse means if he did well in Delaware, he's still a viable candidate? What was that?
No, of course not. Look, Newt Gingrich has been irrelevant for quite some time. Whether he drops out or stays in the race is almost insignificant.
So anyway, so he announces that he will not continue as a candidate. He will drop out effective May 1st, and we expect an endorsement of Mitt Romney around the same time. Is that your understanding?
Yes, we expect an endorsement, and Rick Perry has also endorsed Romney. Remember, he had endorsed Gingrich, but now Romney is the official presumptive nominee. And doesn't have the delegates yet, but he has everybody out of the race except for Ron Paul, and he's collecting all their endorsements. Rick Santorum hasn't yet, but we expect him to at some point.
Rick Santorum is meeting with Mitt Romney, I think, May 4th.
Right.
And there could be an endorsement coming out of that or some kind of an understanding between the two camps.
Yes. And, of course, you know, the also-rans are going to negotiate for speaking times and speaking slots at the convention. They want assurances that the platform will be conservative enough. I don't think there's anything they want that Romney can't give them pretty easily.
Anyway, Romney swept all 5 states on Tuesday, and here he is speaking after Tuesday's primaries.
4 years ago, Barack Obama dazzled us in front of Greek columns with sweeping promises of hope and change. But after we came down to earth, after all the celebration and the parades, what do we have to show for 3.5 years of President Obama? Is it easier to make ends meet?
No.
Is it easier to sell your home or buy a new one? Have you saved what you needed for retirement?
No.
Are you making more at your job?
No.
Do you have a better chance to get a better job?
No.
Are you paying less at the pump?
No.
You know, if the answer were yes to those questions, then President Obama would be running for re-election based on his record.
So if we do have a presumptive Republican nominee, and apparently the RNC thinks so as well, because apparently they're going to be merging, the RNC and the Romney staff apparently will be merging efforts in the next couple of days. The only thing we have to talk about until the convention is VP stakes. And it looks like Marco Rubio had his day in the sun this week.
Marco Rubio had his day in the sun. He traveled with Romney. He gave a foreign policy speech at the Brookings Institution. And interestingly enough, I went to that speech. It was very nonpartisan. It was not the kind of red meat attack on the president that you'd expect someone trying out for the VP slot to give. He said he believes that foreign policy should be nonpartisan. He didn't mention anything that wasn't almost in sync with President Obama's foreign policy. It was pretty interesting.
Everything this year is going to be a comparison to McCain's choice of Sarah Palin, whether that was rushed, whether that was just a bit of panic. And we're going to, obviously, every possible potential vice presidential running mate this year will be, I guess, compared to the way McCain picked Sarah Palin. One of the complaints about Sarah Palin was that she was only in office a short time. She wasn't truly tested or vetted. Marco Rubio has a lot of vetting to do, too, with also only a year and a half in the Senate.
Look, I think that the notion that every bit of this vice presidential decision-making process is going to be compared to the process that McCain went through or didn't go through to pick Sarah Palin is a bit of a straw man. First of all, there's nothing similar about Romney's situation. He doesn't have to throw a Hail Mary pass. He's not broke and behind the way McCain was. He's not going to be making this pick out of weakness. He is going to vet everybody carefully. His personality couldn't be more different than John McCain's. He's going to go through a very data-driven, sober process. And I think that he's not going to pick somebody who doesn't meet the two bottom line criteria for vice president, which are a closet without skeletons and somebody who can be seen to be ready to be president at a moment's notice. Now, whether Marco Rubio meets those or not, I don't know. But there are other people on the short list who might not be as exciting as Marco Rubio, but who meet those criteria. I actually put Rob Portman at the top of the list.
Now, Rob Portman is on everybody's, seems to be on everybody's list. He's the also a first-term senator from Ohio, former congressman, former Bush budget director. And as you say, as you correctly say, he is not Mr. Excitement. Ultimately, I'm trying to figure out what the purpose of a vice president or at least the announcement of a running mate is. Even if it is to excite the base, that only lasts a short amount of time.
I don't think base exciting is the top criteria for Romney. I think he wants to pick someone. Vice presidents can do a couple things for you. Sometimes they can bring a state. Marco Rubio's from an important state, Florida. Rob Portman's from an important state, Ohio. You could argue he's from the most important state for a Republican. Sometimes they can help you do outreach to either the base if you need that. I would argue that Romney has the base pretty well in hand, or an ethnic group like Hispanics. Marco Rubio might be able to help there, although polls are not so clear on that. The vice president could reinforce your brand the way picking Al Gore helped Bill Clinton reinforce his brand as a young centrist new Democrat. Rob Portman is very much of a reinforcement of the Romney brand, sober, expert on fiscal policy, kind of bland, white bread personality, but somebody who's considered serious. Now, one of the biggest marks against him would be that he was the Bush budget director. The Tea Party wouldn't like that very much. But I've found surprisingly little pushback among conservative activists on this vice presidential shortlist. None of them are being targeted as unacceptable the way, for instance, Joe Lieberman was considered completely unacceptable for McCain 4 years ago.
What you're forgetting, of course, is the fact that the reason George W. Bush picked Dick Cheney was to carry Wyoming. Do you think that Rob Portman could help him carry Wyoming?
Wyoming? No. Ohio? Maybe. I don't think it's a guarantee. Vice presidents don't always carry their home state, but I think Rob Portman could help.
Now, I was teasing about the Wyoming part.
I know.
But, of course, we see a lot of history of VPs like John Edwards was supposed to do well, help John Kerry do well in the South and did nothing for him. Lloyd Benson was supposed to help Kerry Texas. That didn't happen. Ultimately, I think it's really, and we've said this over and over again, it's really about the presidential candidate. A region will go for a ticket based on the presidential candidate and not on a running mate. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that. I think in an extremely close race, maybe the vice president could help a tiny bit on the margins in his home state. But I do think that lately you've seen vice presidential picks made because they send a message. Dick Cheney was older, more experienced. He balanced out George W. Bush's lack of experience.
Lack of foreign policy experience,
or lack of foreign policy experience, certainly. Rob Portman would certainly reinforce the Romney message about the economy, about fiscal policy, especially about the deficit. So I think that that would be the overriding issue.
Once upon a time, we used the conventions to nominate presidential candidates. That doesn't happen anymore. Then for the longest time, at least the excitement at the conventions were the naming of a vice presidential candidate. And that doesn't happen anymore either. It's always before that. There is some talk now by some Republicans that maybe Mitt Romney names his running mate well in advance, not a week before the convention, but perhaps as early as May, to have the general election start sooner than later.
It already has. And certainly if you picked a vice president early, it would play right into that. The general election has started in earnest. They're attacking each other directly. The president is going to give his first official campaign rallies next week, at the end of next week, in Ohio and Virginia. There's been no rest at all. In other words, there was no time for Romney to regroup after the primaries. It just was an immediate segue into the general.
You're talking about President Obama campaigning in Ohio and other swing states, but he was also on the Jimmy Fallon show this week. And as you know, he was slow jamming the news on the late night show with Jimmy Fallon.
On July 1st of this year, the interest rates on Stanford student loans, the same loans that many of you used to help pay for college, are set to double. That means some hardworking students will be paying about $1,000 extra just to get their education. So I've called on Congress to prevent this from happening. What we said is simple. Now is not the time to make school more expensive for our young people.
Oh, yeah. You should listen to the president, or as I like to call him, the Prezi of the United Steezy.
You know, Mara, I mean, maybe I'm old or something. I don't know what's funny about this.
Well, it might not seem so funny to you. And guess what? It wasn't funny to the Republicans. They put the American Crossroads, which is one of the super PACs supporting Romney, put out a video where they played all sorts of images of the president on late night TV, wearing shades, singing a little Al Green to say, hey, we elected a celebrity president. And now where are we? So they clearly think that the president has taken this too far and now it's a target.
And obviously one of the big issues between Obama and Mitt Romney during the week is talking about the extension of the student loan interest rate. President Obama is campaigning to keep it at the 3% and change. It would automatically double as of July 1st, and Obama's trying to make this a us versus them issue, but it seems like the Republicans are in favor of that as well.
The Republicans have made a tactical retreat there. They realize this is the wrong fight to have. Mitt Romney said, sure, I'm for keeping the low interest rate on student loans, and the debate now in Congress is how are you going to pay for it? But on this one, the Republicans have decided it's not worth fighting the president. The bigger question, of course, is whether the president can get turnout among young people up to anywhere near what it was last time. He's certainly going to beat Romney in the youth vote. But the question is, will he expand the electorate by the same amount that he did last time? And he needs to win in a lot of key states.
And part of the problem is, I would suspect, that among the 20 to 24-year-olds, the unemployment rate is far higher than it is among the general population. I believe it's like 13-14% among that age. And again, that's something that President Obama, has to take into consideration as he's campaigning for a second term.
Absolutely. I mean, they were excited last time. They felt a lot of hope that they were going to get some change, and a lot of them are dispirited. He still packs college campus arenas, but they have a lot of work to do to get those voters out.
The big story, of course, this week, of course, were the primary sweep by Mitt Romney. But the real focus was in Pennsylvania, because that was also, of the five states, that was the one state that had congressional primaries. And there were some two pretty interesting, fascinating, and maybe instructive results in two congressional races.
That's right. What happened in Pennsylvania was, because of redistricting, two Democrats were forced into races against each other.
Two incumbents, right.
Two incumbent Democrats were forced into races against each other. In one case, Mark Kritz defeated Jason Altmaier. Kritz was, you could say he was the more liberal or the more machine Democrat. He inherited the Murtha seat, and Jason Altmaier was a centrist Democrat, and he went down to defeat.
Well, before you go on to the second race, let me two things about this. First of all, Altmaier voted against President Obama's health care measure. Now, Mark Kritz, of course, was not in Congress when that vote was taken, but he would have voted against it as well. So they're both kind of centrist Democrats. Both were anti-abortion rights. Both were pro-gun rights. But the thing is that Altmaier really went out of his way, it seems, on many occasions to vote with Republicans, certainly against Obama. And the labor unions were not thrilled about that. And the labor unions came out in droves for Mark Kritz. And what's fascinating about this is that this district, 67% of it was Altmaier's seat, and yet Kritz wound up winning, perhaps because of that labor backing.
Right. It shows you how energized labor is this year. It would be easy to say, oh, another centrist representative disappears, fewer and fewer moderate Democrats, fewer and fewer moderate Republicans. But I agree. In this case, the real story is the newly energized labor movement.
And that's true about when Tim Holden lost in the 17th district as well. Tim Holden, a Democrat who also voted against President Obama's health care bill. But the problem for him is that much of his district was new. 80% of it was new, in fact. And it added a lot of liberal areas, Scranton, Wilkes-Barre in the east. And a lot of liberal Democrats never liked the fact that Tim Holden was beholden to the moderate blue dog wing of the Democratic Party.
Right. It shows you the big story of redistricting. Republicans have made their incumbents safer. You see the continued kind of division of the parties, with Democrats getting relatively more liberal, Republicans getting relatively more conservative. The center pretty much disappeared.
I think that's a very good point. We keep talking about how the Tea Party is moving the Republican Party further and further to the right, but the loss of Altmaier, the loss of Holden this week in Pennsylvania, perhaps can make the argument that Democrats are also moving more to the left, which is perhaps making both parties more combative and less willing to talk to each other.
Well, that's true. But the redistricting process really is responsible for this. I mean, if you're going to draw lines that mass Republicans in one district and Democrats in the other, you're just going to have this happen. I mean, the only way you get centrist representatives of either party is when you have districts that have more or less equal numbers of Republicans and Democrats, and they're competitive.
Right. And another kind of conservative Democrat, Bob Casey of Pennsylvania, he won nomination easily. Do you know that if he's reelected, he will be the first Democratic senator from Pennsylvania to win reelection in 50 years? That's how Republican Pennsylvania has been with Senate races. But the Republicans hope to come up with a guy named Steve Welch. He was backed by Governor Corbett, backed by the newspapers, backed by the state party. And he lost to Tom Smith, a former multimillionaire owner of a coal company.
That's right. Smith won the Republican nomination, will face Casey. Presumably he can self-finance. Pennsylvania is an interesting case. Obviously it went Republican in a big way in 2010. However, it's been pretty consistently a blue state in presidential elections. I would say that if the president is in trouble in Pennsylvania in the fall, he's going to be in trouble in a lot of other places too.
One state the president is definitely in trouble in, and one state where is definitely not a blue state, is Utah. But again, Orrin Hatch, the longtime Republican incumbent, first elected in 1976. He, of course, was very aware of what the Tea Party did to his Republican colleague 2 years ago, Robert Bennett, because Robert Bennett was not sufficiently conservative. Robert Bennett lost at the convention. You need 60% of the vote at the convention to get renominated, and you need to finish in the top two if you're going to make it to a primary. Orrin Hatch, while he did not suffer the same fate as Robert Bennett, nor did he win the nomination outright, he will face a Tea Party candidate in the June 26th primary.
That's right. He kind of got his second choice. I mean, he didn't get knocked out in the convention. He also didn't put his opponents away. But I still think Hatch is favored in that primary.
Yes, a very conservative state. Dan Lilienquist, who is his opponent, again, backed by the Tea Party. The issue really may be the fact is that Orrin Hatch has been around a long time. He's 78 years old. He's seeking his seventh term. And that's another problem for Dick Lugar, who's in the May 8th primary in Indiana, been around a long time, also as long as Orrin Hatch, and has not satisfied Tea Party and conservative needs as of late.
No, and he has a really tough primary coming up. If he lost, I wonder if the Obama campaign would look again at Indiana. They've pretty much written it off. It was a state they won, very surprisingly, in 2008.
Before we end this week's podcast, and of course we were talking earlier about running mates who didn't help the ticket in November, here's a running mate that is kind of still embarrassing the party years after he left the Senate. That's John Edwards in North Carolina.
Oh, my God. Yes, there's really nothing we can say. Universal embarrassment and tragedy.
Look, a lot of people, when they think of John Edwards, it's complete disgust, how he betrayed his wife, he carried on this affair, and all these things. But at the same time, do you go to jail for 30 years? Do you spend do you pay a $1.5 million fine because you tried to cover up an affair? That seems to be what the issue is.
Yeah, that's the issue. And certainly this guy's political career is over, and it ended in the most embarrassing and humiliating way possible. And he has no one to blame but himself. But yes, the question is, should this be a criminal offense?
And that is the real question. Before we go, Mara, you know, every time you're on this podcast, everybody says to me, what is Mara Lyson really like?
Impossible to tell.
Okay. Well, I guess the listener will still be left with questions about Mara Lyson. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ken Rudin.
And I'm Mara Liasson.
Join us again next week for the dramatic and tearful return of Ron Elving for It's All Politics from NPR.